Hello and welcome to the programme. You can email Mooney at rte.ie. Today, Terry Flanagan introduces us to the sparrows in his front garden.
I only have to go out of my front door to observe my birds. Yes, my birds, that's what I call them. They're sparrows, and they live in the hedge. And they love a thorny hedge or an evergreen hedge. So something like a firethorn or a cotone aster is an ideal habitat for them.
Ornithologist Eric Dempsey tells us what it was like to record his first audiobook.
Don't Die in Autumn, The Magic and Madness of a Life for the Birds. Written by and read by Eric Dempsey.
And we look ahead to next Sunday's broadcast of The Dawn Chorus. Yes, I'm really looking forward to our annual broadcast of the Dawn Chorus next Sunday morning between 1 and 7am. Can you believe we've been doing this in one manner, shape or form for 26 years now? It's hard to reconcile that we've been on air that long, let alone broadcasting the Dawn Chorus. Mind you, the Dawn Chorus has been around since the beginning of time, almost for millennia. I didn't invent it. We just put microphones on it and brought it to you, our listeners, and then some years ago, further afield to the wider audience with our European partners in the European Broadcasting Union. So let me give you a quick rundown of what's happening next week. You can set your alarm clocks, or indeed stay awake. From 1 o'clock, we go on air until 7 a.m. So between 1 and 4, we'll be bringing you some documentaries, one about the curlew, one about the white stork, and one about the common eiderduck. Fascinating stuff. We'll have some traditional Irish music from Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny. No better. And then from 4am to 7am, we will be with you live from Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove, the spiritual home of the Dawn Chorus. Myself, Niall Hatch and Jim Wilson will be there. We'll be joining Aina, Richard, Terry and Eric Dempsey at their respective homes in Ireland. And then we'll be saying hello to our colleagues in BBC Northern Ireland, BBC Wales, BBC Scotland, and some friends in the Isle of Man and Brittany for a Celtic-themed Dawn Chorus this year. And all of this will be broadcast via satellite to our partners in the European Broadcasting Union. Everybody keeping a respectable distance from each other and observing their respective government guidelines in relation to the coronavirus. So I'm really looking forward to it. We'll talk a little bit more about it later on with Jim Wilson. Jim is our man in Cork, and it's from Kuskany Marsh. We will be broadcasting, as I said, quite close to Jim's home, in fact. And if you listen to this recording I'm playing for you now, you can hear the prominent singer here is the wren, not the dominant species in the reserve, but it's a loud singer. For such a tiny little bird, it sings the loudest, always does. And it's very hard sometimes to hear other birds. Well, you can hear them, but to distinguish them as individuals when you've got the wren sitting on top of the microphone. Seems like it sits on top of all the microphones. Anyway, the other evening I went out because there's a resident blackbird holding territory just outside my front door in a silver birch. So I made a little recording. Hope you enjoy it. Here it is. Isn't it just wonderful to think that nature can create such sounds? Blackbird, of course, one of the birds to sing first in the Dawn Chorus. And why? Anybody know why, class? Come on! Because it's got big eyes. The birds with the big eyes catch the light. So they wake up early. Actually, speaking of catching the light, yesterday morning, dawn was supposed to be at 5:30, but the birds were singing well before that, so they catch the first glimmer of light, they really do. But where I'm living, it doesn't last very long. They sang for about 20 minutes, if even, and that was it. At full pelt. Hopefully it's going to get stronger and stronger, which is why we broadcast the first week in May. It's the peak time to hear the birds singing. So as I said, can't wait, and I hope you will join us in the morning next Sunday between 1 and 7. Let's join our panel now, starting with Aina Nilana. How are you today, Aina?
I'm great, Derek. Wonderful as usual. Isn't the weather glorious with the sun shining and the sky blue? Hopefully it will be like that at dawn when we're having the dawn chorus. It would be great if it was.
Well, I tell you, I was in Harvard Park yesterday and there's a beautiful avenue in Harvard Park of apple and cherry blossoms. It just looked delicious.
Yes, it's certainly the time of year for all of those flowers, for the cherry blossom and the plums and the pears and apples, all of the things. So it really cheers your spirits up to see all those lovely flowers and the bees then coming to pollinate them.
Richard, how are things in Malahide?
Hello, Derek. Yes, things are wonderful in Malahide. I have humble birds around me. There's a pampas grass plant in the front garden and it's being gradually denuded by house sparrows carrying the pampas away for their nests. And next door we have jackdaws nesting. I was thinking of your crow with the stick because I watched a jackdaw trying to get a large stick into the hole where the nest is and in absolute frustration banging and banging, and eventually he dropped it, and the passage in between our two houses is a litter of similar twigs that were too big for him to get into the hole. I can't help but feel your crow last week was somehow triggered by nesting. Carrying sticks somewhere is part of the nesting behaviour of crows.
Well, it's funny you should mention that because it seems like the entire nation has opinions on what that hooded crow was about, because later we'll be talking to the children of St. Mary's Boys National School in Booterstown who all have opinions on what the hooded crow was up to. But we'll talk about that later on. Now, if you're a regular listener to Mooney Goes Wild, you'll know Declan Murphy for his astute and impossibly patient observations of some of Wicklow's lesser seen species, whether they be woodpeckers high in the trees around Annamoe, pine martens along the River Avonmore, or badgers in a 100-year-old set outside Ashford. His first fleeting glimpse of a kingfisher as a child was a defining moment in the life of the young naturalist. Almost 40 years later, he set off again on a quest in the hope of reliving that unshakable moment and to study the brightly coloured bird during its nesting season, a seemingly uncomplicated mission. But the River Avonmore proved hesitant to reveal the secrets of the beguiling object of his desire. Declan's adventure is detailed in a new book. It's called The Spirit of the River. And he joins us now from that same river, the Avonmore near Lara in County Wicklow. Hello, Declan. How are you today?
Hello, Derek. I'm great today. I'm actually up at the river in Lara, the Avonmore River, and it's an absolutely gorgeous day. Clear blue skies. The river here is alongside me and it's quite a pleasant river. It's a slow flowing river where I am at the moment, and it's surrounded by gorse trees and oak trees. And the oak trees are still only coming into leaf at the moment, but they're filled with the first of the summer migrants that are coming in, and I'm surrounded by the songs of willow warblers and blackcaps.
Tell us about your love for the kingfisher.
Well, I've always loved all birds, and kingfishers have always been one of my favourites, I suppose because they're so brightly coloured. They're a really vibrant coloured bird. And I suppose like many birds that naturalists see, we often can't remember the very first time we saw a house sparrow when we were growing up, or the very first time we saw a blackbird. But I actually do remember the very first kingfisher I saw. I think I was about 10. And it was my father who showed it to me. We were on holidays in Wexford and we were walking along a river and we were at this very old bridge looking over it. And that kingfisher flew under the bridge and called, and my dad pointed out to me. And I really remember it so clearly because we saw a lot of things that day. We saw foxes, we saw long-tailed tits and the kingfishers. And it always stayed in my mind. And with the writing of the first book, which was all about the woodpeckers, while I was studying the woodpeckers, I had to walk along this stretch of the river and I used to see the kingfisher, but I was very much concentrating on the woodpeckers. So I didn't have time, I suppose, to stop and look at the kingfisher as much as I'd like. But when I finished studying the woodpeckers, or the book had been published, I decided, you know, I really would like to get to know the kingfisher an awful lot better, because I realised, although I'd been watching it since childhood, going right back to that time when I was 10, I really didn't know that much about it. And so I sort of decided, I think I'd put a bit of time into actually watching this bird. A common bird, a bird that lots of your listeners will have seen, but maybe one they're not as familiar with as they might like to be. So that's why I set out looking for the kingfisher. It was just to fulfil that desire to have a bit more knowledge on as many of the birds that we enjoy in our countryside as possible.
Now, you say that the kingfisher captures the public imagination with its effortless finesse.
That's right. I think it's a bird that I know people who have never even seen a kingfisher actually out in the wild, but it's a bird they know of because it's photographed by an awful lot of photographers due to the colours and that. And unlike an awful lot of our other birds, it has a very spectacular way of feeding. It dives into the water, which is quite an achievement. It catches the fish and comes back up onto the branch. And an awful lot of people would kind of think that's a very straightforward task. But anybody who's even studied physics in school will know about light refracting through water. So fish in the water are never exactly where they appear to be. So every time the bird is feeding or diving into the water, it's making all these amazing mental corrections to achieve this very straightforward, simple task, which I think is just amazing for such a small bird to achieve this. It's just a wonderful little event to watch.
Declan, I must compliment you on your wonderful book, because a kingfisher is a bird that we all know. And indeed, when I was lecturing in college, I used to show my students a collection of birds. And the only one they all knew was the kingfisher. They didn't know other things that you think they should, even though none of them had ever seen a kingfisher. It used to amuse me. And as you say, because of the amount of time it's on calendars and the like. So you would think something like a kingfisher would be very obvious. And certainly, I have many times, like yourself, looked over a bridge, seen the flash of blue go by, seen the flash of blue coming back, but I have never seen it anywhere else. And you point out in the book, and I find this really, really interesting, that the colours of the kingfisher, which are orange and blue and white and very, very vibrant, yet you maintain that when it's sitting on a branch in the woodlands with the leaves and the dappled light, you do not see this very vibrant coloured bird because it mingles in so well. So are they around and we don't notice them, which seems absolutely impossible looking at how coloured it is because of the fact that it melts in so well with the background colours?
They certainly are a widespread species, but they have very large territories. They would certainly need quite a lot of a river. They would certainly need a very long stretch of river to rear their family upon. So their habitat is very widespread through Ireland, clean rivers. But I suppose so much of the river is taken up by areas that we can't access that they can go unnoticed. Certainly, as you pointed out, the bridge is the classic place where people go over a bridge over a river and they stop to admire the river. They look over and the kingfisher shoots underneath. But they can't walk along an awful lot of that river. So the kingfisher is quite able to live out its entire life, except for that fleeting little glimpse under a river bridge. Now, as you pointed out, it is quite amazing how such a brightly coloured bird, when it's sitting quite close to you, just blends in. And people find that amazing. They say, how can it blend in? It's bright blue and bright orange, and it's sitting on a bank of green and dark browns. It should stand out. The first thing about it is it's very small. They're very, very small. They're only about 5 inches in length. The other thing is when they're sitting on the branches, they're very still. They're not like a bird like a blue tit or a long-tailed tit that's always active, or a warbler that's always hopping from branch to branch. They will sit under an overhanging branch for maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, and they won't move. So even if you're walking along the river, movement won't catch your eye. And the colours are actually designed in some ways to break up the bird's outline, because when you've got the sun shining through leaves, it creates this dappled light that dances kind of, you know, along the river's edge and kind of plays on the water, and then the water reflects up. So you've got the dappled green of many different shades that actually breaks up the bird's back, and then the water reflecting up onto the orange actually just makes the orange almost blend in with the reflections of the water. So it's quite surprising. In some cases you can look at it and you can't actually see the edge of where the bird blends into the vegetation behind it.
And of course you had been very familiar with the bird itself, but the quest in your book seems to be to find out where the bird is nesting, to find the bird's nest and watch what happens. And of course you knew, and people know, that birds like kingfishers, the kingfisher in particular, nests in a hole in a bank. And so you wanted to find the hole in the bank where the kingfisher nested. And it nearly seems to me, looking at how you describe this, that at the end of the day, you actually found the nest site by accident.
That's right. I suppose, like many people, I hadn't seen the actual nest site myself, despite having watched kingfishers for years. And I was very familiar with pictures people had taken over, possibly in England and other parts of Ireland, of what I would describe as the classic image of a kingfisher's nest site. And that would be a bare earth bank on the river's edge, perhaps where the bank had fallen off in a vertical cliff almost, and it's just completely bare, and you have a small little hole, and that's where the kingfisher was making his nest. They actually burrow out a hole themselves. They land on the bank and tunnel into the bank itself. So I had thought naturally that the real sandbank edge would be where they would be. And as I walked along the river, I'd seen the birds, so I knew they were nesting somewhere on the river. I was going to the actual places where I was presuming they would nest. I would walk along until I found the bank and say, now, is this right? And there would be no sign of them there. And as I described in the book, eventually I found the kingfishers, and there was two of them sitting on a branch. And I knew by their behaviour that they were probably quite close to the nest. So I was watching at that point. And one of them then flew out and flew under a bush and came up. And the bank it was actually using was completely hidden. It wasn't exposed. It was hidden by vegetation. So it was actually flying up underneath it, which really surprised me. Because if the kingfisher hadn't actually flown at that moment up towards the bank, I never would have seen it. I would have walked straight past that bank. And that was quite a surprise to me, because I had, just like so many people, always looked at the classic nest site. And that's what I was looking for. And it just went to show that maybe that's why I hadn't seen them, that perhaps there's more of them nesting in very hidden locations rather than the very prominent areas that people were more expecting them to be in.
I wonder about the colour scheme thing. I've heard it argued by ornithologists that in fact the kingfisher isn't blue and red. Basically, it's a drab brown colour, and that the colour is due to a thing called Tyndall scattering. After John Tyndall from Loughlin Bridge in County Carlow, is it, or County Kildare, Loughlin Bridge, but the famous John Tyndall showed how the blue of the sky is due to the scattering of light reflected off particles. Now, it is argued that when light, bright light, falls on the structure of the feathers, that it's reflected and bounced about and comes out in blues and greens and reds. But that if the light isn't strong at all, as it would be if the bird was hiding or something like that, it lapses back into a rather dull colour and is quite well camouflaged in that situation. I don't know whether that's true or not. Declan, you might comment on that.
I've heard that actually myself. I think it's a bit like, it's more or less like an iridescence, that the stronger the light, it is the structures of the feathers that reflect it. Now, I don't know if it would actually be a brown bird. I've certainly never seen any indication that it would go that dull. But certainly, when the light hits it, it explodes with colour. There's no doubt about that. When the sun actually hits it, it reflects it off in the most unbelievable spectrum of colours that glisten. But once the sun moves off, it's not like that. Now, a lot of other birds are very similar, and hummingbirds, as you almost certainly know, are very like that, that you'll see a hummingbird that is completely brown looking, and then it turns its head and the whole neck and the chin explode into a vibrant purple, and it depends on what way the light is. The kingfisher certainly does give that impression, but I don't think it gives it as strong as that if the light doesn't catch it right, that it goes brown. Or certainly I haven't seen that myself. But it certainly does always surprise me that for such a brightly coloured bird, it can disappear and then be so prominent when it sits out in the sunshine on a rock. You say to yourself, well, how could you ever miss that? And yet, when you spend the days putting in the time and looking for the bird, seeing it is the first challenge, actually finding it and to be able to see it. But then even when you do see it, it's hidden a lot of the time and it blends in. It does. I mean, it's certainly one of the more surprising things about a kingfisher.
on the subject of coloration and camouflage, there are two situations where you need camouflage. One is where you're likely to become prey and you want not to be detected by your predator. The other is where you want to fool the creatures you're going to catch on. In other words, the fish in this case. You know that, of course, light, the colours are attenuated underwater. They decline. Various colours decline more than others. Now, a fish looking up at a branch with a kingfisher on it, does the colour scheme, the bright red and blue, make it less visible because the fish is underwater? And when it dives into the water and is down where the fish are, it's got now to find the fish very quickly before the fish swims away. Is the colour scheme important? Is that where the camouflage comes in? Are we looking in the wrong place when we ask, why is it bright red and white blue?
Well, certainly from the fish's perspective looking up, the kingfisher is paler underneath. And we see that in a lot of other animals fish that are in the sea. They will have paler underneath and darker on the back to match in that something feeding above them, trying to catch them, will look darker against the sea, and something below them, when it looks up, will see a paleness against the light coming down from the sun. I think the same does apply to the kingfisher from the fish's point of view looking up, in that the lighter coloration, the orange, is actually what's visible through the water. And if you've got light coming in against mixed vegetation, where there's browns, where there's greens, and in the autumn where there's oranges on the actual trees, from the fish's perspective, that orange of the kingfisher must blend in from where it's looking. So I would certainly imagine that part of it assists the kingfisher in catching its prey. I think once it's flown down and hit the water, I don't think there's any aspect of camouflage. I think it's calculated the direction of the fish is going, the depth, the speed, and is able to get it before the fish can react. From above, it's hard certainly to see how the dark blue, certainly when the bird is flying, the camouflage, I think the bright, vibrant blue that's down a kingfisher's back as it flies along a river, I don't think that could offer too much camouflage in flight. Again, perhaps against the dappled light of vegetation, it does blend in. It could actually aid in camouflage. I'd certainly say, though, for the fish's point of view, that the paleness underneath is certainly aids the bird in actually hunting its prey.
Declan, you used sound quite a bit once you had established what was going on, like where they were. So you could detect the sound of the kingfisher as it came along the river, and later on when its young had hatched out and it was bringing food to feed the young, you could actually hear the sounds the young were making inside in the nest. Is this because you have particularly good hearing, or is it just a matter of getting your ear in and anyone would hear these particular sounds?
That's an interesting question. I actually think it's a combination of both. I have been told by a number of people that I do have very sensitive hearing and I do have very good hearing. And I can pick up an awful lot of sounds that other people don't seem to be able to pick out. When I'm out walking, I'm often walking along and saying, oh, there's a woodpecker calling, or there's something else calling. And they're saying, well, we were talking, how did you even hear that bird? So I do seem to be able to tune into an awful lot of sounds very easily. Also, once you're familiar with the sound, naturally it will register in your mind an awful lot quicker. If you're listening for it, yes, if you're by yourself and you're listening for it and you know what you're listening for, you're tuned in, then I suppose anybody can pick that up. But I think I definitely do have a better hearing ability for birdsong, for small bird sounds. I use my ears an awful lot. Now, the kingfisher's call is very, very distinctive. It's a loud whistle. And we don't have too many birds on the river that do actually whistle. So for me, it's a very, very clear sound. It's a very, very readily identifiable sound. Strangely, there is one other creature that has a very, very similar call, and it's not related to the kingfisher at all. And it actually caught me out one day when I was looking for the kingfisher on the river, and that's the otter. And I was very fortunate in coming across a family of otters. And I was looking for the kingfisher and I started hearing this whistle. And the whistle was just ever so slightly different to the whistle of the kingfisher. But I started looking for the kingfisher. I said, well, it has to be a kingfisher. I can hear it. And I was looking along, and what surprised me was it was coming from under the bank near some stones. And it turned out to be a family of otters, and the young otters were calling, and they have a very loud, clear whistle as well. So it's very interesting that both the kingfisher and the otter, two creatures that live in exactly the same habitat on the river, have almost identical calls. And I was also very, very fortunate in being able to watch both that day.
Well, Declan, it's a wonderful read. Thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome, Derek.
And more details on Declan Murphy's book, The Spirit of the River, can be found now on our website, rte.ie/Mooney.